requiring is that the area plan for all user groups be paid for by the shore fisheries group. That's what you'd be requiring.
How about all the users? Not just the shore entities?
I think you have a tough time assessing all the user groups realistically. Just a question of priorities, when are you gonna require the department to do it? Mr. Gustafson, could I ask you a question? If we were to change the exemption in section three or make it effective rather than 1995, make it effective 1997, would the plans be in place for Kodiak and the Alaska Peninsula at that time, under the department's priorities?
Mr. Chairman, I believe we'd have Kodiak complete. Alaska Peninsula, I'm not so sure.
But possibly?
Possibly, yes.
So in that case, we could zero out the fiscal notes if we made it to 97?
That would help. That would help.
Would that be acceptable to the committee?
So would you zero out the fiscal note or reduce the fiscal note to go for Kodiak, but you still wouldn't be able to handle the peninsula, so you would still need some fiscal note, wouldn't you?
As the chairman accurately pointed out, we, of course, are funded as a matter of course to do area plans anyway. And it's a matter of when we get to these particular areas. Kodiak is scheduled in the near future to begin 2 to 3 years from now anyway. An area plan, by the way, as I think I mentioned, takes 2 to 3 years from beginning to end. And there is a portion of the Alaska Peninsula that hasn't been completed, and it's also scheduled a ways down there, about at least 5 years away. So I think Kodiak would probably be done as a matter of course. The Alaska Peninsula, we'd just about be getting there or just have recently begun it.
Representative Sharp.
One last question, Mr. Chairman, through the chair. Would you say that it's any particular reason why these areas have not got an area use plan? Is it because of lack of enthusiasm and push from those areas, or is it just because of the state departmental priorities that put them at the tail end of the list?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sharp, the answer to that question very simply is that compared to other areas, A, there isn't that much state land, and B, there aren't that many competing uses for that land, and that's kind of the scheme that we've used to determine what goes first.
So this wasn't brought on by the particular area. This is just the way it worked out because of lack of competing.
Yes, we've, by necessity, of course, tried to address areas like the Mat-Su Valley and the Tanana Basin and so on first, because that's where the human activities and conflicts are.
So would the committee object to an amendment that would change the effective date to January 1 of 1997 and then zeroing out the fiscal note? I'll make that motion. Is there objection? Without objection. There's a motion on the floor to move the bill out as amended with the company zero fiscal note.
Zero fiscal note.
Is there objection? Without objection, so moved. Next bill I'd like to take up is House Bill 143. Representative McLean is the prime sponsor. Representative McLean.
Thank you very much, Chairman Navarre. And if I could have the indulgence of the committee, I'd like to read the report because it's complex, the bill. House Bill 143 deals with municipal entitlement. And the purposes of committee substitute for House Bill 143 is to restore equity in the general grant land entitlement process, to return the emphasis of the program to its intent of developing independent and strong local governments, and to temper the Department of Natural Resources' broad discretion in determining the process and procedure for transferring general grant land to municipalities. And sectional analysis and justification have been provided in your backup, and you have the booklet before you here. It's the red folder booklet. Briefly, the bill will, one, remove the population cap of 20 acres per resident enacted in 1987 and return to the original formula of 10% of vacant, unappropriated, or unreserved land for municipal land entitlements. Two, it'll allow cities to request an expedited entitlement. Three, it'll require review and comment on land selections by the Department of Community and Regional Affairs. Four, it'll establish an appeal process for municipal entitlements. Five, it'll require Department of Natural Resources to take into consideration the cost of surveying and alternatives to preserve access when applying the 4-to-1 width to length requirement of the shape and size of parcels. Six, it'll require Department of Natural Resources to consult with the Department of Community and Regional Affairs prior to adopting regulations on the general grant land program. And seven, it'll set out a policy statement for the general grant land program. And eight, it'll add certain lands classified as wildlife habitat in the definition of vacant, unreserved, and unappropriated. The state constitution was based on the premise that municipalities should be independent and self-governing. Clearly, the intent is to provide for strong local governments, and since the passage of the Mandatory Borrow Act in 1963, municipalities have been able to acquire state land for their local use. General grant land provides a means of creating a tax base, of generating revenues through land sales and leases, and a land base for community and public purpose. Over the years, the responsibility of making policy decisions on municipal entitlements has gradually been given to the Department of Natural Resources. Now, all of the decisions are made by DNR, and they exercise tremendous discretion in deciding the rules by which justifications are reviewed for municipal purposes and for evaluations of selection for state interests. Municipalities have little say in the award process. They really don't have the ability to work with DNR to jointly determine land classifications, and they have no appeal process which evaluates these land selections for municipal interests. House Bill 143 will help to restore equity and to provide checks and balances in the municipal land entitlement process. This morning, Commissioner Hines called to say that the administration would support House Bill 143 as long as they could delay the certification of new entitlements until January 1, 1994. And that's after the state completes the transfer of 20 million acres of land from the federal government. The administration is supportive of House Bill 143, but is concerned that it would burden the department with additional deadlines to meet during this time when all available resources will be directed toward completing the federal land transfer. In keeping with the administration's priorities, I will be offering an amendment to this bill, which would in effect put a moratorium on new certifications until after January 2, 1994. At that time, DNR would then have 2 years to complete the delayed certifications. The amendment would also delay any recertifications for municipality entitlements, which may be affected by this legislation. Commissioner Hines also said that the administration was concerned about Section 6 relating to the size and shape of the parcels. In its original version, the bill prohibited the department from placing restrictions on the size and shape of parcels. As a compromise, we amended this language in House Resources Committee to require that when placing restrictions on the size and shape of a parcel, the commissioner will take into consideration factors such as the cost of surveying and other alternatives to preserve access before applying the restrictions. This compromise should meet the intent and concern of the administration. Since we have worked out our problems with the administration, I would ask the Finance Committee's support, and I would like to note that since we will be putting a moratorium on new entitlements and new certifications until after 1994, this bill will not be generating new work for the department. Therefore, I recommend that the Finance Committee prepare a zero fiscal note for House Bill 143. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
We're going to move this amendment.
Pardon?
We're going to move this amendment.
Representative Brown.
Thank you. So does this generally result in the municipalities getting more land than they get under the present law? And are all municipalities equally entitled to take advantage of the greater opportunity? Assuming I'm reading this right, and there is a greater opportunity. How would it affect the different municipalities?
It would affect them. There are some municipalities that have formed since 1987, and therefore they would get more land. And it does include wildlife habitat, so that would increase. And maybe the Department of Natural Resources could answer that question. And also, Department of Community and Regional Affairs, there's a person here that deals with municipal entitlements, too. Okay. And also, Marty Rutherford is here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown. Question being, which municipalities would benefit under this bill? The bill, as amended in the Resources Committee, I believe, says that all newly formed municipalities after June 1st, 1986, qualify, and it also reconstitutes the basis under which the department calculates municipal entitlements. And as a result, and there should be a packet or a graph in your packet, and if you look at that, there have been four boroughs that have formed since that date: Northwest Arctic, Aleutians East, Lake and Peninsula, and Denali. And the result is that the entitlement of the Northwest Arctic Borough would increase from about 133,000 acres to 285,000 some odd acres. Aleutians East and Lake and Penn would stay the same, and the Denali Borough would receive about another 9,400 acres from its existing 40,000. And then, of course, any newly incorporated municipalities out into the future.
So, continuing, Mr. Chairman, it would not affect Anchorage, for example, or any local government formed before that date, 1987?
That's correct, Representative Brown.
Thank you.
The effect if the Local Boundary Commission required the expansion of an existing local government as part of setting up, restructuring boundaries?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kopanen, good question. My understanding is that it would not affect borough expansions. For the reason being that the entitlement is calculated as of the date of their incorporation, whenever that would be. So a newly informed municipality or borough would receive their entitlement certification as of the date that they were incorporated. Under existing law, the department has a period of time after the date of incorporation to calculate their entitlement and certify it.
Even though they may be
even though they may expand, yes.
Responsibilities, added responsibilities.
That's correct.
I noticed the reference is to the 1978 amendments to AS 2918. We have reason to wince every time we see that date, since that what gave us the problem with the mental health and the university trust lands, and are going to present us with a future problem in terms of the public school lands, which are under the Morrell Act, the congressional and Supreme Court term requirement. do in this case? Are we compounding the problem for the municipality or for the state? Or is the state going to bail out all the municipalities who took over mental health or school lands as Anchorage did, for example?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kobanen, this bill has no bearing on mental health lands, and I think the same legislature in 1978 that dealt with the changes to the Municipal Entitlement Act as well as mental health, but I think they're completely distinct entities, at least I hope so.
Well, we're still in the middle of a lawsuit about what our mental health plans, for example, and I anticipate that the next shoe to fall is going to be public school lands, which are in that area. I'm not sure, you know, exactly how we deal with that or whether we want to look at it, but I feel that, you know, I have a foreboding that we're going to have. Every time we go into the municipal entitlements, we do something we didn't anticipate with the land. The problem being that, you know, if there are some lands that are probably then the belonging to one of the trusts, the municipality becomes... one of the, shall we say, debtors in that instance on the lands. That's happened with the mental health lands.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, I would like to reflect upon, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gustafson, you mentioned that Northwest Arctic Borough would gain more entitlement, and that is partially correct because what Northwest Arctic Borough has done has had a partial entitlement. And that comment should be clearly accurate when you make a comment like that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McLean. Representative McLean is accurate with her comment because the changes to the municipal entitlement law in 1987 did say in statute, you're absolutely right, that the Northwest Arctic Borough's entitlement was a partial entitlement pending completion of the governor's municipal entitlement policy, which was completed last year by the former governor and sent to every legislator. And, you know, that's where we are right now. The Northwest Arctic Borough's entitlement in 1987, incidentally, was about 13,000 acres, and as a result of the changes in 1987, did go up to 133,000, which is where it is today.
Are there further questions? Mr. Gustafson, if not, who's the guy? Jeff Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Smith. I'm an assembly member for the Northwest Arctic Borough, former Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Community and Regional Affairs, and a former member of the Local Boundary Commission. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and especially appreciate Representative McLean introducing this piece of legislation, and I will be speaking in support of it. When we agreed to the language in the 1987 bill, it was because of the state's desire to take a look at its land entitlement policy and determine what would be fair under that policy. We agreed to the 20 acre per capita with the provision that a final entitlement for our borough would not be determined until the administration came out with their policy. That policy is now completed and it is 10% of the view lands. And this bill would authorize the borough to receive that 10% of view lands. And there's no reason why this legislation should not apply to our borough. If we want the rural areas of the state to assume more and more responsibilities for government, we need to give them the tools to carry out those additional and increased responsibilities. This municipal entitlements are going to be a significant way for them to generate revenues to accomplish that. If the land entitlement was important to to the boroughs and governments formed in the 60s, it's absolutely critical to the governments that have been formed in the 80s and 90s. We appreciate the enthusiasm the Hickle administration has shown for this legislation, and with Representative McLean's comments that they now support this legislation with the amendment that Representative McLean will offer it, we very much appreciate that. We've discussed the amendment with Representative McLean and are supportive of that. We think that there are a number of provisions in this bill that are important, and this is in the best interest of everybody to see go through. The land entitlement issue has been politicized extensively, probably going back to 1978. If this legislation's adopted, I think we can end the politicalization of this and stop having us local governments come to the legislature to arbitrate our disagreements with the administration on particular issues. I think this solves a wide range of problems and would be extremely important. And the one thing this legislation does, it leaves intact the state's best protection, and that is the state's best interest finding. Should a municipality select land that the Department of Natural Resources feels is such state interest, that land would not be conveyed to the municipality. But this legislation does provide that the municipality's interest is heard and is determined. I'll conclude my testimony and be glad to respond to any questions that you or any of the members of the committee might have.
Are there questions by the committee? If not, thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much.
David Vandenberg.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is David Vandenberg. I represent the Environmental Lobby. Good afternoon. While we support in principle of equality here set forth and more regional autonomy, the Alaska Environmental Lobby still has reservations regarding this bill. We see at least two of its provisions that threaten the state's management practices and the environmental integrity of these various areas. The first problem that we see is the inclusion of wildlife habitat in the VUU land. Certainly much of Alaska is habitat, but still this land is, there are different degrees of habitat in these lands, and we'd like to see that those protected. And we still have some substantive problems with the alteration to the 4-1 ratio. The state's best interest provision offers some protection, and the right of DNR as well to make a case-by-case judgment on each of these. They stand us in good stead, and they make a good step towards satisfying our concerns. And we appreciate that. Finally, through the entirety of HB 143, there's an absence of environmentally assuring language. I think presumably land uses on municipal land would be different than any land uses that the state had used previously. And there's no assurance that this discrepancy in land use would be accounted for by any kind of a environmental contingency plan, or will show that there will be any adverse impacts on adjoining lands. We would like to see that included. And with that, I would thank the committee for the opportunity to testify and conclude, respond to any questions, if any.
Are there questions by the committee? Representative Brown.
Thank you. The wildlife habitat you're referring to is on page 3 of the bill?
Yes.
And refresh my memory, wildlife habitat, how is that distinguished from critical wildlife habitat? And what's this? I was under the impression lots of land ends up getting designated wildlife habitat, and that it's sort of, if there isn't any other use there, that's the default classification.
Okay, I think that was, I can't speak from a statutory standpoint, but my understanding is that in accordance with DNR's need to classify land, there are certain areas that are classified in degrees. It was my understanding, my layman's understanding, that there are gradients, there are degrees of habitat, ranging from most critical all the way down to, I don't know what the end would be. But our concern, though, is that this land, these selections would allow them to select within the municipality the most critical area, perhaps a staging area or something like that. But again, that probably might be best answered by Mr. Gustafson.
Thank you.
I want to announce, if there's further questions, if not, thank you. I want to announce that House Bill 134, 176, and House Bill 200 will all be held over until next Monday. So we're not going to get to them today. I don't have anyone else left to testify. Representative McClain, you want to make your amendment?
Yes. I'd like to move amendment, and I'll just the amendment to change the language on page 4, line 9 through the period on line 11, and it would be to delete all material. And do you want me to read the?
No, we have the amendment. Okay. Everyone has the amendment.
Also move it.
Is there objection to the amendment? Without objection, amendment number 1 is adopted. Is there further questions, Representative Brown?
Question to the sponsor. So what is the reason for including the wildlife habitat as a category from which selections can be made?
Okay. I'm trying to get the backup for that wildlife habitat.
Could we have Mr. Gustafson just clarify that question about
the... Mr. Gustafson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, the question was, as I recall it, is wildlife habitat a holding category when the department classifies land, and basically if there is no highest or primary use, does it go into wildlife habitat? Answer to that is no. Our holding category, if we have one, is resource management. And if it is indistinct, the number of uses that are possible on a chunk of state land, and nothing immediately has been determined through the planning process to be a primary use, then it ends up being classified as resource management, and then it's available for a wide variety of purposes. Wildlife habitat is identified through a planning team, through a public process, as a classification to implement a primary use of wildlife. And that means that land's highest and best use has been determined through a planning process to be for wildlife habitat protection. Degrees of wildlife habitat, of course, critical areas versus less critical, you don't distinguish that through the classification. The plan itself would indicate whether one area is more important than another, but the classification doesn't give you that.
And if I could ask Mr. Gustafson another question, do you think it's appropriate for municipalities to select wildlife habitat?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, the governor's policy with respect to this bill, I think, was distributed in your packet, and you'll see in there that this issue is addressed.
Mm-hmm. Representative Sharp.
Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Gustafson. Would this bill... allow blocking of total watersheds or right-of-way access to other remaining state lands by more or less strategic strip selections, or does it still require fairly contiguous blockage of selection?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sharp, the bill with the amendment that came out of House Resources I know because I was there for most of the discussion. House Resources had a number of concerns about the so-called 4-to-1 depth-to-width ratio that the department uses. We had argued in House Resources that certainly the department needs to have the ability to configure or have some limits on the configuration of borough selections, no matter where they are, for the reasons that I think you just inferred. Just as the state itself is limited by BLM's rules and regulations in terms of lands that we can select. I think the amendment helps somewhat alleviate our concern, but the concern does remain.
Yeah, I just didn't want us doing it to ourselves, but the feds did to us, basically as far as overall state lands. One other question. Do you know offhand what the average acreage is per resident at the time the Fairbanks North Star Borough was organized?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sharp, not offhand. If one has a statute book handy, the Fairbanks North Star Borough's entitlement is 2965010, and you can look up there what the entitlement is, and I'm sure maybe Community and Regional Affairs or somebody can give you a population estimate for the date of corporation and figure it out.
Thank you.
Representative Brown.
I don't have any more questions. Well, if I could ask the sponsor, is there some particular land that one of these affected local governments is attempting to select, or is there some specific thing? Because it looks like in that even the Hickel administration says they don't think it's appropriate to make selections from that. Unless they're, go ahead.
Through the chair to Representative Brown. The administration, as of this morning with my conversation with the administration, Commissioner Hines, he said that he didn't have any problems if we did delay the recertification and certification of the municipal entitlements until the federal land entitlements were taken care of. And he did not discuss wildlife habitats.
Does it affect significantly the amount of acreage that the affected local governments would be entitled to get?
No, one of the criteria, as Mr. Gustafson stated, was that resource management is also considered wildlife habitat, and they usually consider that when they're doing their land entitlements.
So if there's not
taken into
a particular parcel that you're attempting to select and it's not having a significant amount of effect on the acreage, would it be okay to take it out?
Well, I'll have to look at the amended language.
I would just propose to delete that at the bottom of page 3. Delete the underlined language on page 3, lines 30 and 31.
The committee substitute on it's from the Resources Committee.
So that's on page 4, lines 2 and 3?
I think what we do is delete section 9, because that's the only amendment to section 9.
No, just take out the sentence. I don't want to delete the whole thing. Before we do that, could we also hear from Marty Rutherford from DCRA about wildlife habitat?
Mr. Chair, I think it's important to just point out that under the Hickel administration position that I believe is part of your packet, the page that's second from the last refers to the Northwest Arctic Borough, Aleutians East Borough, Lake and Peninsula Borough, and Denali Borough. And in the far right three columns, it shows you what the present entitlement is, and then the next one over shows me what the entitlement without the 20-acre cap would be. And then the final one over shows you what the entitlement with wildlife habitat in there. And I would just like to point out that the inclusion of wildlife habitat into the VUU does make an acreage difference, not only with these four boroughs, but undoubtedly with any future boroughs. It simply increases the base for the 10%.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Brown.
Would it be possible to allow them to have the larger base for selection, but just let them select something other than wildlife habitat? I don't object to them getting more land. I just would like it if they didn't select wildlife habitat.
Mr. Chair, I'm a little out of my league on that particular thing, and I think that perhaps DNR is more capable of responding to that. I do know, though, that many times when DNR is going through the categorization of lands, they apply dual classifications, and sometimes and oftentimes habitat lands have more than one classification. So I think it would be difficult to necessarily exclude wildlife habitat and yet still increase the VUU base. I don't know. Perhaps Mr. Gustafson can answer that question.
Classifications that are retention, state keeps them, other classifications that are what we call disposable categories.
Was this included prior to the changes?
Mr. Chairman, this bill is the first time that wildlife habitat would be treated as selectable land under a borough entitlement process, and also that wildlife habitat would be eligible as part of the land base from which an entitlement was calculated. Both.
Thank you. Representative Brown?
So would it be a feasible idea to allow it to be calculated for part of the land base, but still keep it not eligible for selection?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, depends on your objectives, I suppose, but, that is one option. I'm not going to speak. The preferences on that depends on whether or not the body feels that wildlife habitat is a selectable category.
Okay. I will move that we delete Section 9. Is there objection? Without objection, Section 9 is deleted. That's the reference to the wildlife habitat. Okay. What is the pleasure of the committee? Representative Brown.
I move that we move the bill from committee with individual recommendations as amended, and with these fiscal notes. Community and Regional Affairs fiscal note.
There's also a DNR fiscal note.
But it's zero, right?
All attached. We can zero that out with the change of this.
Now the finance committee see that.
Okay. Is there objection? Without objection, so moved. Next bill we have up here is House Bill 83. Okay, it's my intention to take public testimony today on House Bill 83 and then hold the bill over until next Wednesday. Wednesday of next week. So we'll begin with
300.
I guess we could begin with begin in Anchorage with Ann Whalen.
Chairman Navarre and McLean and members of the committee, my name is Ann Whalen. I'm a retired Anchorage School District science teacher and a summer resident of Homer. I spent 6 months researching and authoring a study called Logging in Kachemak Bay State Park, Public Values at Risk, which some of you may have seen. And I'd like to highlight some of the findings of that study. Three areas were considered in the study. The first one is the impact of the buyback on Kachemak Bay State Park itself. The second is the economic values at risk in the areas of tourism and fishing if the buyback does not occur. And the third is the intrinsic values at risk. The study took the form of a number of surveys and also included research work. We found that the buyback will benefit Kachemak Bay State Park in a variety of ways. First of all, the integrity of the park will be maintained. Right now, the park is in the form of a donut, and with the donut hole being the part that's being considered for the buyback. If the buyback goes through, there will be new opportunities for the users, as well as better boundary definition. And the buyback will give these lands the protection that they need. Under the economic surveys, we included tourism and fishing interests. We surveyed 74 different businesses that are operating in four areas of the tourist industry. We surveyed providers of lodging, providers of air, water, and land tours, wilderness lodge hosts, and providers of education programs. We had 40 businesses responding. We found that in those potential 74 businesses, that over 200 jobs were there existed, many of which are seasonal, but some are year-round. We found that a gross income of almost $9 million was generated by just those 74 businesses. And we found that those folks were serving over 500,000 visitors to the Homer area. Obviously, some of them are repeaters. Only 8% of the folks that took advantage of those programs and businesses were from Homer. The other 92% were from South Central, from Anchorage, from the South 48, and from Europe and Asia. We asked what kind of impact these businesses anticipated if the buyback did not go through, and particularly in the case of the wilderness lodges, the tours, and the education programs, the anticipated impact of logging in the area was very, very negative, with actual disruption of some of those businesses a likely prospect. We asked about the cost of relocation of those businesses, and many businesses felt that they could not even bear that cost of relocation if they had to do that. We asked the percentage of growth of those businesses, and we found that the providers of tours had gained 30% over the last 5 years. The education programs had grown 180%, and the wilderness lodges had grown 208% in the last 5 years in the number of persons served. We found that they make their purchases of their supplies from all over the state, primarily from Anchorage and the Kenai Peninsula. We also surveyed the real estate providers in the Homer area. We received 10 out of 19. We received responses from 10 out of the 19 persons surveyed. Those folks predicted an average of a 10% decline in property values in Homer if the buyback does not go through and if logging occurs. That would have direct implications for the property valuation there. The assessed value would decline almost $28 million if these predictions come true and if all other factors remain constant. We've also heard from people across the bay whose properties are adjacent to what might be logged in terms of the loss of property values to themselves. We did a survey of 100 people on the waiting list for SLIP people, 57% of the respondents said that they would reduce their trips to Kachemak Bay if the logging occurred, would go elsewhere if this happened. We also did a telephone survey in Homer, and we found that 80% of the people there opposed logging. I think that's no news to anyone. We do have a small percentage that do favor it because they see the opportunities for jobs for themselves for the next 9 years or so. We surveyed fishing interests. As you know, Homer is a site of commercial and sport finfish and shellfish fisheries. We interviewed commercial fishermen. Their concerns were primarily focused on the possibility of loose logs and the impact on anadromous streams. We also documented intrinsic values at risk, including scenic values, recreation values, cultural values, because the area is very rich in archaeological sites, wildlife, and habitat values. And so, to summarize, the study documented over 200 jobs presently existing, many of which are at risk if the buyback fails and the logging occurs, with a gross income of over $8.8 million annually in just the four areas of the tourist industry. These existing businesses are experiencing considerable growth. Add to that the protection that the buyback will provide for the commercial and sport fishing interests, for the wildlife, for the scenic, recreational, and cultural values, and the buyback becomes, in my mind, an excellent long-term investment in the future. And so I'm asking you to please consider these values as you discuss this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Phillips.
Yes, I did take a look at your study earlier today. You give a comparison of the economy that exists today, and you mentioned something about 200 jobs. I want to know on the flip side, how many jobs and how much money is being pumped in as a result of logging. Just a second.
The trading company representatives could best answer that question for you. From what I understand, the jobs directly would be at least 50 jobs in the logging camp itself, and then there would be the offshoots of support services, which would include barge personnel, probably lodging for people in Homer, probably helicopters and so forth, plus all the food and other services that would be provided. And again, I'd say that Timber Trading Company could probably best answer that for you. But again, bear in mind, that's only over a period of 9 years, where these others have been in existence for a much longer and are anticipating growth at a very accelerated rate.
Right there. I listened. That interrupted.
Are there any further questions? If not, thank you, Ms. Whalen. I'd like to, in Juneau, take testimony from Bruce Baker.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bruce Baker, Deputy Director of Fish and Game's Habitat Division, and I know there are a lot of people who want to testify, so I'll just briefly indicate that the department is supportive of the bill. It does represent good wildlife I'd like to just say, Mr. Chairman, the Department of Fish and Game does support the bill. Kachemak Bay is just far enough south on the Kenai Peninsula to support the coastal forest, which regenerates itself pretty much on an individual or patch tree basis rather than as a result of fire, usually. And in that respect, it does represent sort of a northern extension of the coastal old-growth forest. It is very valuable habitat in that respect, and harvest would convert that in a way that would reduce its capacity to support the wildlife species that are there. Incidentally, I have been working and talking to John Sturgeon of Timber Trading Company in the last week or so, and on the side he did indicate that, underscore what he'd said earlier publicly, that they do have imminent plans to go into that area. So I mention that just for your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Baker? Representative Sharp.
Maybe he's the wrong one to ask, but I'll ask, see if he is. Mr. Chairman, Is there any indication that the bark beetle infestation is getting into these mature stands of trees in that area?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sharp, in a different life I had did some work on that end, so I might just address it. The spruce beetle can go into Sitka spruce that's in that area, but it's far more common in white spruce that exists further north. So it isn't anywhere near the threat there by any means that it is farther north on the Kenai Peninsula.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Baker. At this time, I'd like to call David Stutzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is David Stutzer. I'm the chairman of the Kachemak Bay State Park Citizens Advisory Board. I'm a 32-year resident of Alaska. I've been a resident of Homer for about 11 years. I've been on the board for 6 years. And since starting on the board, I've been actively involved with not necessarily the negotiations, but the keeping up to speed on what's been going on with the land exchange with Sildovia Native Association. It's an emotional issue for a lot of people, myself included. I'll try to be as unemotional as I can in my presentation. There are a lot of things involved, of course, logging being one of them. $4.5 million of this bill are going to go to buying the timber rights that are currently held by Concor. And, of course, development in an undeveloped, undeveloped part of a park, an inholding of the park, but undeveloped so far. And, of course, spending money, and I think that's kind of the feeling I get from the people I've talked to so far is it's more the money than the philosophy of whether we want to reinstate this to be part of the Kachemak Bay State Park. This issue has been going on, this land trade issue has been going on since the Memorandum of Understanding was signed between the state and the Sildovia Native Association in 1979. Two partial trades were done. Two failed trades. And part of the reason that the land trades failed were because of differing opinions on what the land was worth. There is agreement now between the administration, that is DNR, and Sildovia Native Association and the holders of the timber rights on a value, and that's $20 million. At this point in our history, in the state of Alaska, state lands are becoming more and more scarce as municipal entitlements are granted and borough entitlements. And the minute you have a smaller land pool, the value of the remaining land goes up. The value of this land will go up. I always think back on a personal incident that happened to me about 10 years ago where I had an opportunity to buy a parcel of land about 100 yards from where I now live. For about the same price, I bought half the amount of land with a trailer. The previous piece had a house on it. And the only reason I bring that up is whatever happens to this land, I can guarantee you next year or 10 years from now, $20 million won't look like a lot of money anymore. So I'd like to have you think about that. In Florida, recently, they spent $42.5 million on 59 acres, $7 million on 6 acres. That's better than $1 million an acre. I know it's kind of an extreme example. The populations differ. I'm sure the state budgets differ. But if you'd refer to the graph, I believe you have the average cost per acre of acquisitions, a national average for the United States in the past 4 years, as compared to the final statistic, there is roughly $841 per acre for Kachemak Bay State Park. I think we're getting a heck of a deal. The investment is not just real estate. The investment is tourism, and it's been talked about before, and I won't belabor the point, but having spent several years in Homer as a young boy, I've seen the growth of this town. Since the mid-70s, the growth of the visitor industry has been tremendous. I can recall about a half a dozen charter outfits on the Homer Spit in the mid-70s, about 77, and I'm sure it's at least four times that much now. It's just an indication of every other area of the visitor industry on the Kenai Peninsula, and I think in Alaska in general. It's not just a local issue, because the visitors that come into the area come through Anchorage. If they use the road system, they come through Fairbanks, Delta, they travel, and they spend their money all the way down. There's a lot of support across the state for this bill. I'm sure you're probably tired of hearing what a unique ecosystem it is, but it really is. It's a marine park that's relatively close to the road system. It's easily accessible. It's about 3.5 miles from the end of the Homer Spit, a short hop by boat. School kids use it on Sea Week for their interpretive programs, their interpretive programs for visitors. There's ongoing education for all segments of the population. And this would be diminished by the logging activity and the logging itself. Chinapu Bay, there's several pictures here around the room. Chinapu Bay is the real thing. It's not SeaWorld. I mean, you go out there and you can see actually what people go down to SeaWorld or the aquarium in Seattle and look at. Here it's where it all started from. In conclusion, I'd urge you to pass this out of committee and bring it to the House floor. Tourism is a clean industry. It is more than likely the industry that we're looking for to help augment and possibly replace the oil money that we get at this time. And as we all know, oil, the revenues go up and down. So I think it'd be more of a sure thing. There are always other bills to pay. I think this is a one-time shot, and I think it's an investment that you will not regret. At $840 an acre, I think it's a tremendous deal. There's a lot of support for this bill around the state, and you know, I was amazed about 3 years ago when the last land trade failed, and I was amazed because somebody, and it wasn't the advisory board at that time, picked it up and went with it again and said, let's get this moving. The Kachemak Bay Citizens Coalition started negotiations between the state, Soldovia Native Association, and Timber Trading Company. The reason I bring that up is I think if it doesn't happen this year, it may... There's going to be somebody that's going to bring it up again, and in the future it's going to be probably more expensive, and it's also probably going to be less desirable if there are clear cuts on it. But I don't think the issue is going to go away. So I just want to urge you to preserve the opportunity for future generations to use this land the way it is today, for preserve the opportunity for visitors to experience the last frontier that they come up here to experience. I'd be open to any questions if I can help you with those.
Representative Tolkien.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, as you know, I've supported this legislation in every legislature that it's come up and voted for it on the floor and in committee. But I have to say that when I think of the amount of time and effort that have been put in convincing the legislature and the number of POMs and letters and beautiful postcards I've received, that one tactic that wasn't tried, which is what we did in Fairbanks and the Creamers Field, which is a major fly stopover point for ducks, geese, swans, cranes, and everything, a crucial habitat area, that we started out by raising money locally. And in the past 10 years, the amount of effort that had gone into convincing the legislature had also been used to buy an acre apiece, you probably would have half of it already. And I still intend to vote for it, but I've been converted a long time. So the preaching sometimes goes a little too far.
If I could, I'd like to comment on that, just to follow up on that. There's timber rights that have been sold by Seldovia Native Association outside of the park that this bill would not purchase. But the Kachemak Heritage Land Trust has reached an agreement with Timber Trading Company. If the bill passes, these timber rights would be given to Kachemak Heritage Land Trust to preserve the view, which is their intent.
Yeah. By themselves, they would not have no timber value. They wouldn't. There's not enough timber.
Right, that's correct. Any other questions?
Representative Boyer.
Thank you. Other than having voted on this issue at least twice, I'm not familiar with historical problems, particularly with regard to land trades, and also with regard specifically to the agreement on values. You mentioned, I think you said, that we finally had agreement on values. So I'd like you to, if you can, walk me through the agreement on values, agreements between who and all that type of information. I'm literally ignorant on this issue. And if someone else is more qualified to answer questions with regard to the history of the land trades and why those failed and kind of walk through that a little bit, I appreciate that too. And I apologize for interrupting you, but I didn't want Gary Augustus to leave if he was the right person to answer some of this.
Yeah. There are at least two people here that have more information. I could give you some information, but wouldn't be very complete. Mr. Gustafson would be one, and Al Miners is here too. So I'll take my seat and let them answer your question.
Thank you, Gary or Al or both.
I just might say that my interest is this is still a tall drink of water by any standards, and I'm involved up to my ears in another major land issue, and that has a lot of dollars associated with it, and so we're looking at all kinds of other options. So I'm real curious, specifically with regard to the agreement on values, and also on the land trade bill over there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boyer, for the record, Gary Gustafson, Director of Division of Land and Water for DNR. Let me just give you maybe a 3-minute capsule overview and how it fits together, including focusing on what I think you're interested in, prior land trade efforts. Kachemak Bay State Park was created in 1970 by an act of the legislature. In 1971, of course, we had the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. That act provided that the corporation of Seldovia was entitled to 69,120 acres of land. One provision in that act also provided that they could obtain state-owned lands up to 69,120 acres if that state land happened to be within their village withdrawal. Village withdrawal is the original township and the adjacent townships that happen to be next to it. The community of Seldovia, the Seldovia Native Corporation was shortly thereafter formed and made their selections, and as Fred Elsass, the president of Seldovia, has often stated before numerous committees, they felt they had no choice but to select land in Kachemak Bay State Park because it was the only land really available to them. And as a result, they took about 29,000 of their selections in the park. And that's what, of course, we're dealing with right now. In 1979, we had an agreement between Cook Inlet Region, Inc., the State of Alaska, the Kenai Peninsula Borough, and the Seldovia Natives, which had a bunch of components, but probably the most pertinent were that the state and Seldovia would agree to an equal value land exchange to remove Seldovia completely from the park, and also, I might add, incidentally, to remove Siri from the park as well. To try to implement that agreement, formed in 1979, the state and Seldovia sat down and began negotiations. In the early 80s, culminated in about the mid-80s, the state of Alaska and Seldovia were able to accomplish two what we call small trades that together included about 5,000 acres, in which the state was able to receive 5,000 acres of Seldovia's land in the park in return for an equal value amount of state land elsewhere, primarily on the Kenai Peninsula. The reason why we never got more than 5,000 acres was a series of things, but primarily due to disagreements over the quality of the land that the state had made available for selection by Seldovia. And secondarily, we had substantial disagreements over the appraised value of both the state and Seldovia land. The issue dealing first with state land available, by the 1980s, the state of Alaska, even though we have millions of acres, frankly, no longer has the developable, the high-ticket real estate that we used to have. It's already gone to municipalities, it's gone to native corporations, it's gone to private ownership. And to be quite honest, we don't have nearly the income-producing real estate that Seldovia was looking for. And so when they looked at our portfolio of land, frankly, they didn't see as much as they had hoped to see. And so they were disappointed that there wasn't more land that they could receive. And Mr. Elsass also accurately makes the point that at least one or two areas that he wanted, Granite Point across Cook Inlet, were not made available to Seldovia because the state figured it was in the state's best interest to retain certain areas. In Granite Point's case, it was for the prospect of a major state port to facilitate the development of the Beluga coal field. And prior commissioners and governors had decided that the state ought to retain that track and should not go to Seldovia. Anyway, these frustrations over what was available in the land selection pool and the value of that land eventually resulted in the disintegration of the land exchange discussions. And a couple of years ago, with the impetus of quite a few people, including the newly formed Ketchumak Coalition, the citizens, many of which are here and have testified in the past, the residents of the Homer Kenai Peninsula area, the Kenai Peninsula Borough, Representative Navarre, then Representative Swackhammer, and others, we got together and had a series of meetings and decided that we'd make one last attempt to close this deal. And we got out the old maps and started talking about land and so on, and frankly, every time we did, we just couldn't find the right lands, or the values just didn't quite work out. And eventually, we did have a pool of lands appraised, and we did actually sign a preliminary exchange agreement to exchange some lands, but the value of those lands became quite contentious, and we had a valuation differential between the state's appraisers and Seldovia's appraisers that ranged from our value of about $12 million to Seldovia's value at one point of about $25 million for the same lands. We tried mediators, we tried appraisal, reconciliation. Frankly, that just didn't work because the parties were too far apart. And eventually, we ended up with what, through a series of meetings and other events, came to be the package that is now before you. And that was the proposal to purchase Seldovia's inholdings and timber trading company, or Concor's timber rights, for $20 million. And those were based, the $20 million has its basis in land appraisals, but it also has a few deviations because there's a public interest value associated with park acquisitions. And also, you know, we've got a wide fluctuation in the value of timber from any given time. And $20 million was a figure that all parties agreed was acceptable in terms of compensation to Seldovia and Concor for the value of their land and timber. So, in essence, that's just sort of a short summary for those of you who haven't heard that before of where we are today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With your new $3.6 million capital initiative to identify $20 million of the best prospect lands in the state for our remaining entitlement, don't you think that there's a prospect of at least $20 million worth of good, tradable, developable mineral resource land available? I mean,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boyer, perhaps, but let me clarify. First of all, the position of the Seldovia Native Association Board of Directors has been that they aren't interested in land unless it can give them an immediate dollar return. And they're primarily interested in lands close in to the village of Seldovia. I can tell you that the lands that we can still select are a long, long ways from Seldovia. We have nothing anywhere close to Seldovia that we can select. And also, I'll speculate further, because I'm personally familiar with the location of all the BLM lands left for the state to select, that there may indeed be some valuable minerals out there, and perhaps even some oil and gas, and perhaps even some other associated values. But a lot of it is going to be long-term in terms of its prospect. And Seldovia, frankly, has so far given us indication that they're interested in revenue-producing lands that they can basically turn around and start making money off of. They feel, incidentally, and I won't put words in Fred Elsass's mouth, but he feels that that's what he's got right now with the inholdings in Kachemak Bay State Park.
I might further add that this has been literally this attempt to reconstitute the park has been going on since 1972. When they chose the land, and the frustration level that all parties have gone through, and particularly SNA, I think that the likelihood that we could get back to the bargaining table is not very good. I've sat through the meeting since 1985 and am familiar with the history before then. I think you have a real difficult time getting SNA back to the table. And in addition to that, Timber Trading Company is going to proceed, at least that is what they have indicated, with timber harvest this year if this isn't purchased. So they only have 9 years or so on their that they have to have it harvested by, and their intention is to go forward with timber harvest. Representative McLean.
Thank you very much. I do have a question. Seldovia Native Association, that's a village corporation. And what about the regional corporation? We do have the subsurface rights that have to be dealt with, especially if you're dealing with Native corporation lands. Where does that play into?
I can answer that, Representative McLean. The Cook Inlet region is working with some people from DNR right now to try to come up with a value for their subsurface rights within the park. And I guess Carl Mars from Sirius supposed to be here next week, and I guess I'm hopeful that we'll have some type of a number at that point. Representative Jackal.
So, Mr. Chairman, does that then mean that it's possible at a future date you'd come back and ask for $20 million more for the subsurface?
No, Representative Jackal, I don't intend to move the bill today. I already mentioned that. I would hope that we can get the number so that it can be considered for inclusion in this bill, and the value is not $20 million. Representative McLean, do you have another question?
Yes, I did. You mentioned about some acreages of land within the Seldovia. Could you repeat the numbers again? And what would the value per acreage be at this point in time?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McLean, you're interested in the value of the Seldovia land in the park?
Mm-hmm. And the total acreage?
The total acreage they still have in the park is about
24,000
acres. Okay. And the value of that, as I mentioned a couple of years ago, Seldovia did an appraisal that initially put the value of those lands at $25 million. This is the village-owned surface estate only. Mm-hmm. And then later was adjusted to a number around $22 million. The state contracted with an independent appraiser, and that appraiser's dollar amount for the same land was $12 million, a little more than $12 million. We then submitted the values, the two appraisals, to an arbitrator appraiser, several of them as a matter of fact, and we ended up with a report that said that the Seldovia and Timber Trading Company interests were worth approximately $17.8 million. The appraisal game for large acreages is somewhat difficult, as you might imagine, and there's certainly some variability. And also the concept that SNA, Seldovia Native Association, has projected is that the lands ought to be appraised as not just a traditional market value sense, but with a public interest adjustment associated with them to reflect their value to the state as a whole.
I want to address this also just to try to help clarify it, and that is that with respect to the $17.8 million, which was the price that the total value was supposed to be, there was disagreement as to the value of the timber under that overall appraisal. The timber was subsequently appraised and negotiated between Timber Trading Company and the state to come out with a value of, I think, $6.4 million, of which $4.5 is included in the bill. So when you added when you tried to put the value together at 17.8, when you add up what SNA and their, they felt their value was worth, plus what Timber Trading Company felt their value was worth for the timber, you came up with a value of about $32 million, I believe. Is that correct? And through mediation process and getting different appraisals and negotiating, that value was finally ended up with a 15.4 and 4.6 for the timber. Representative McClain.
Yes, to continue within that vein of thinking, what if the legislature decided to amend the bill and lower the amount? Do you have any idea? Have you gone beyond that bargaining? What if they lowered the amount, and do you have any idea what Seldovia Native Corporation would respond to for a lower figure?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McClain, properly that question, of course, can only be answered by SNA. It has been posed in the past, and I guess I'll just add something based on what I have heard Fred Elsass say in the past, but I encourage you to perhaps contact him directly. And that is that the corporation is now interested in this land acquisition on a cash-only basis, mm-hmm. and they will accept an overall package that includes $15.45 million cash for the corporation for its land. And that $15.45 million, as Representative Navarre just mentioned, mm-hmm. Is the portion of the $20 million that would go to the surface estate, the land owned by SNA. The remainder would go, $4.5 million would go to Concorp for its timber rights.
Representative Phillips.
Are we on teleconference?
Yes, we are.
Yeah, Mike, I just have a question here. The borough and Kenai passed the resolution, and they stated 15.5, and for the land and the timber rights together. This resolution was passed on April 2nd of this year. So I don't know how to read this resolution, frankly. Because we mentioned the 15.5 here. For the land, but no mention of the timber rights. So I don't know what the position is of the Kenai Borough.
Yeah, I guess the only thing I can guess, and Mayor Gilman was here earlier, is that it must have been an oversight when they had the bill up, because the value has been since last year, and they're aware of it. $20 million. It's 15.5 for the land and 4.5 for the timber. That's the $20 million.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then, I'm just trying to figure this thing out right now. You just mentioned that Sedovia was interested in just the 15.5. And that Representative McLean mentioned something about lowering the figure, but that still leaves the timber rights an open question. Is that correct? Facts?
Yes. That would, if you only went with 15.5. The $20 million purchase of the land and the timber rights. Representative Boyer.
And so why can't we just purchase the timber rights?
Right. Because the timber rights run out in 9 years, and they could sell them again, and we could buy them back 50 times.
Mr. Chairman, just to add to that, the timber rights were sold by SNA in May of 1987. They are 10-year cut rights, so they will expire in May of 97. So if you just buy the timber, Seldovia sells them again in June of 97.
Mr. Chair, if I might add, I'm Al Miner, South Central Region Manager for State Parks. That question has been raised in other committees, and if you just bought the timber rights, you would not buy any public access rights to the land. Further, the land could be developed in other ways, such as recreational cabin sites, second homes, or other activities which would be not in keeping with the purposes of the park as originally established.
Representative Phillips.
And now I'm confused.
Essentially,
the people in Homer do not want this thing clear-cut, as stated by the earlier witness here. 80-20% or something to that effect. So, you know, the main purpose is to keep it, from clear cutting. Now you're saying they want access to the park and everything. They already have access. They just don't have access to this 24,000 acres, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Phillips, I think the goal of the effort from the start, clear cutting has been the issue that's most in front of the public.
Right.
The goal from the start, though, has been to return these lands to the public domain as part of Catchment Bay State Park. You may recall in the Anchorage area, there was an effort in the early 80s to restore the north half of Chugach State Park from the selections by Clutna Natives Incorporated. That was done through a separate agreement.
Right.
So, the focus is certainly on timber, but I think the long-term goal is to maintain these lands in their natural state and to keep them in the park for the public.
Representative Sharp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does a question, maybe these gentlemen could ask, answer, do all village corporations have the option of selling off their ANSCA land?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Of course.
Mr. Chairman, yes, they certainly do, and each corporation decides internally what its policy towards acquisition and retention should be.
Okay. Well, I guess my next question, if 5,000 is already gone, this is 24,000 more, and you only had 69 to start with, they got over 40% gone already, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sharp, actually, their full entitlement, 69,120, and the amount that they selected of that in the park was 29,000. And so, yes, if we were to acquire all 29,000, then they would be reduced in their entitlement, but they've already received some state acreage in return for the 5,000 acres that we've already acquired. And the corporation board of directors has internally decided that they would be willing to take 15.5 million cash for the 24,000 acres that remain in the park.
Right.
Representative Mackey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate you allowing me to ask a few questions. I've taken particular interest in this bill. I just wanted to state that I have been involved in a Native corporation of this nature as a director and chairman of the board over the last 9 years, and I wanted to lend to a couple of statements that were made about the selection process of ANSCA lands. It is very true that there were very stringent requirements as to where the corporations could or could not select land. It had to be within their core townships and different areas. A lot of it was extremely limited during that selection process, so I can understand how this land selection took place in the first place, and that's real easy to figure out that. The subsurface rights issue that Representative McLean brought up is also another one that I think is very crucial, having dealt with a regional corporation, Sea Alaska, in subsurface rights problems. That will be a very difficult one to resolve because, you know, they're going to, regardless of who owns the surface estate, the regional corporations do own the subsurface rights, and there is jurisdictional problems and access problems and a lot of things that come out of that. I guess what I was wondering, obviously $20 million is a very large price tag that's subject to, you know, a lot of people's concern, but I guess I'm somewhat supportive of seeing this issue resolved because of the nature of it being a state park, and not only because of the importance of the people of that particular area. But my question is, and maybe it's already been addressed, and I apologize if I'm bringing up something that has been, but has a land exchange with Seldovia Native Corporation, has that thoroughly been looked into? Because, you know, if it's the dollars that they're looking for and the rights to the timber and so forth, there is other timber lands available on state lands that possibly could be exchanged for the same value, which would accomplish killing two birds with one stone. I see people snickering, so it must have been already dealt with. But it is a very viable option, and I was wondering what the status has been on that and what the cooperation has been from both the regional and Seldovia into looking into something like that.
Actually, Representative Mackey, they